Understandably, national security is of paramount concern today for our nation. But what happens to the life of an innocent man suspected of being a terrorist? Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of A Person of Interest by award-winning author Susan Choi. Susan's novel, American Woman, based on the kidnapping of heiress Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army, I know we all remember that, that book was a Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist. Her first novel, The Foreign Student, was winner of the Asian American Literary Award. I'm delighted to welcome you, Susan, to Between the Lines. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Person of Interest starts with a noted computer scientist being killed in his office by a mail bomb. The math professor, whose office happens to be next door, is never labeled a suspect by the FBI, but designated as a person of interest. Is there a technical definition of person of interest?
You know, I was never able to discover whether or not there's an actual technical definition. As far as I know, I'm pretty certain that it is a kind of meaningless insinuating term. It means that no one can call you a suspect because they don't really have enough to pin on you, but they think that there's something fishy enough about you that they kind of want to draw everyone's attention to you.
Mm.
I found press releases from, I think, the Department of Justice addressing just this question. I think it was in the real-life case of Stephen Hatfill, the scientist who was never charged with mailing anthrax but who was named a person of interest in that case. And journalists wanted to know from the government, what does that mean? And the government had to admit that it didn't really have any legal meaning.
Lee is a mild-mannered, rather aloof professor. How does he go from being a bystander to a person of interest? Tell us about this man, Lee, and what is it about him that created this kind of suspicion about him?
Well, Lee is a difficult person. I mean, he is the kind of man who, by the age of 65, which is how old he is when the book begins, he's driven off a couple of wives. He's driven off his only grown child who isn't exactly speaking to him, although she has avoided even having a confrontation with him to tell him that. She just has sort of faded away from his life. He's not close to colleagues or friends. He doesn't know his neighbors' names. He's very, very much an isolated, he's almost a hermit, but, you know, he teaches his classes and he goes about his business and he believes himself to be really a normal human being. And I think he is, but he's just one of those not terribly warm, not terribly fuzzy human beings. And that personality gets him into trouble when he finds himself, you know, very, very near this terrible violent crime.
And it's almost as if he really can't play the role of being innocent.
I love that you said that, because that's exactly the way I thought of it when I was writing the book. I kept thinking, being innocent isn't just a matter of being innocent. You actually have to play a role. It's funny because, you know, we think of innocence as being this authentic, inherent characteristic, and yet I was realizing more and more that there's something very theatrical about it when you're under the sort of press scrutiny that Professor Lee is under. You know, he isn't good at going out to the grocery store and smiling and saying hi to people. Once he realizes that everyone in his community is looking at him funny, they look at him funny, and he, I think understandably, starts to act funny in response. He becomes freaked out,
right.
And
yeah.
That freaks people out.
Right. Lee seems alienated, not only from the general population, but even within the academic community. Talk about that environment.
Well, Lee, like I said, is in his 65th year, and a lot of things in his life haven't worked out the way he hoped. As a young man, he had all of the ambitions and all of the dreams and all the optimism that we all have, not just for things like his marriage to the one woman he ever loved, or his you know, fatherhood to his beloved daughter, but also in terms of his career. You know, he dreamed, he's a mathematician, and in his 20s, he works with a picture of Einstein taped over his desk, and at some point, he realizes that he's not going to be that person. He's not going to be the next Einstein. And by the time he's 65, that accumulation of disappointments in himself has become hard to bear, that he has not been, you know, a major figure in his field or even a sort of a minor figure in his field. He's just hung on. Mm. He's just hung on.
Mm-hmm. Is he based on anyone in particular, any people that you've met or may have known?
He isn't based on anyone in particular, but I have to say, you know, with many, many caveats, that my father was the starting point for Lee, and then, of course, Lee becomes, you know, his own person. My father, when he read the manuscript, which he loved, by the way, said, you know, I know I'm not Professor Lee, but there are certain idiosyncrasies in there that he could have recognized as his own. And then Lee becomes very much his own character and a much darker person, a much unhappier person, and a much more tormented person.
Actually, your father, in a way, did have something in common with Lee because he, if I'm not mistaken, was classmates with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
That's right. That's right.
Tell us about that.
That is the odd little piece of family trivia that really got me started on this book. When the Unabomber was in the news in the late 90s, my father and I were both really fascinated by that case. I think a lot of people were. And when Ted Kaczynski was arrested and revealed to be the Unabomber, my father was thunderstruck because he had been a graduate student in mathematics at the University of Michigan with Kaczynski in the early 60s. So that strange coincidence in, you know, my family's history was the thing that kept sort of tugging at the back of my mind for a couple of years, and that's really where this book grew from.
You mentioned in the book a manifesto that in the book he's called the Brain Bomber because he's attacking high-tech scientists. What is this manifesto? As a matter of fact, your father said that he read Ted Kaczynski's manifesto when it was published.
That's right. That's right. Well, the Unabomber was the figure on which I really did closely base the Brain Bomber, who in my book is a very marginal influence. I mean, it's his horrific act of sending this letter bomb that sort of sets the plot in motion, but he's not actually a central character to the book. The central character is Professor Lee. The Brain Bomber in my book does pen this manifesto in which, very similar to Kaczynski, he sort of puts forward this idea that certain human beings have to be eliminated for the good of humanity as a whole. And this actually resonates with Lee on many levels because Lee, you know, as we were just discussing, is coming to terms with the fact that he hasn't managed to be a hot shot, as he thinks of it, in his field. He hasn't made a big contribution. He hasn't really made much of any contribution in his own estimation. And so this idea that certain humans are worth more than others really stings for him.
So let's back up a moment. The Brain Bomber, his objective is what?
His objective, and again, it's not central to the book, but
right.
Like I say, his acts really, they set in motion this chain of events that sweeps Professor Lee up and changes his life forever. His objective is to eliminate certain people who he feels are responsible for technologies that are damaging society. Mm-hmm. And this is very similar, of course, to Kaczynski's M.O. And I should say also that in my book, the Brain Bomber is named by the tabloid press. And one character actually jokes that he, the bomber, was probably hoping for something a little more suave.
How did the social isolation of Lee and the Brain Bomber, because obviously the Brain Bomber, we learn, is a very isolated character also. What impact does this isolation have on each of them?
Well, you know, there are similarities between them, and one of the things that happens in the book is that the Brain Bomber, whose real identity turns out to be that of someone that Lee also knew in his past, reaches out to Lee. He writes him a letter. He actually really wants to make contact with someone. And this, of course, has disastrous effects for Lee because the FBI, who is monitoring the mail that everyone at the university is receiving after this letter bomb, they see this letter come into Lee's mailbox. And Lee doesn't realize that his mail is being watched. And that's sort of the first thing that starts causing trouble for him. But the Brain Bomber and Lee are both very, very isolated men, and they share certain traits in common. For Lee, his social isolation has made him really unable to understand how he looks and seems to others. And so although, again, he's an innocent in his heart, his behavior after this catastrophe is, you know, it's extraordinarily awkward, verging toward antisocial, and he doesn't understand that people are watching him and that what they see is making them suspicious of him.
Do you think Lee was receiving more scrutiny because he was Asian American, and especially relative to it being a high-tech kind of situation?
Well, I'm not sure if the high-tech aspect of it really came into it, but for me, from the beginning, his race always was relevant. This character for me was always an Asian American man, and for me it was always going to be the case that, you know, I don't want to hit the reader over the head with it or be didactic or be preachy, but it's just fundamental to the way in which Lee is seen by his community. You know, his community is all too ready to believe the worst of him, and his race has a lot to do with it. It always did for me in this story.
Really? So you feel that there was a negative kind of automatic assumption of guilt because he was Asian?
Not automatically because he was Asian, but given the other factors that begin to predispose investigators and colleagues and neighbors and just onlookers toward believing that there's something fishy about Lee, mm-hmm. his race plays into it.
Mm-hmm.
He's not race neutral to people. All it right. plays in.
And once again, it's the fear of the unknown. They don't really know him either. Yeah.
Well, and they're also, yeah, they don't know him, and they're sort of ready to believe more nefarious things about his aloofness than maybe they would have been ready to believe about a person of a different mm-hmm. race. I mean, there's a certain stereotype believed about Asians. You know, they're shifty, they're mysterious, mist-enshrouded people. We can't figure out what they're thinking. I think that a lot of those very, very hackneyed racial ideas play into the way in which the members of Lee's community start to see him once they're given an excuse. You know, before he's in proximity to this bombing, people just sort of don't really notice him. But as soon as he's kind of in the spotlight, that factor, his race, does become relevant.
And often minorities, black, it could be, like you said, Asian or Latino. Unfortunately, oftentimes people do have a tendency to believe the worst. It's almost as if we've become a country of guilty until proven innocent.
Well, I think that there's a lot to that, and it's not all about race. I mean, one of the things, I utterly agree with what you're saying, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way in which the media is sort of obliged to deliver the news to us. They have to move so quickly now, and everyone wants a narrative. I mean, all of us consumers of news, we kind of want a coherent story. We want someone to explain what's going on to us, and so, you know, the press try to do their best, and I have enormous respect for journalists and journalism, and my husband works for a newspaper, and so I'm not one of those people who says, like, oh, it's the media, blame the media. But I do think that in a lot of recent real-life cases involving people of interest, you know, like I mentioned Stephen Hatfield, Richard Jewell, who was thought to be, you're familiar with
this story.
Here
in Atlanta, the Olympic
bomber. That's right.
That's
right. And, you know, the press sort of had to run with that story. They were under such enormous pressure. And, I mean, you know that it turned out to be the case that he wasn't guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the press had to sort of tell a story, and he was this overweight guy. He lived with his mom. He seemed like a bit of a loser. And tragically, he sort of fit the bill for people. So I think that it's less guilty until proven innocent than it's – we all want to – understand the world, and we all feel like we have so much to take in that if someone presents sort of a coherent narrative to us, we want to believe it's true.
Right. If you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines with Susan Choi about her latest book, A Person of Interest. It's a gripping novel of an innocent man suspected of terrorist crimes. Lee's situation also reminds me of the plight of, is it pronounced Win Ho Lee?
Yes, that's right.
He was, tell about him, a Taiwanese-born American citizen.
That's right, that's right. Win Ho Lee was an American citizen, a scientist at Los Alamos, and in the late 90s, he found himself at the center of an investigation into alleged selling of you know, secrets to the Chinese government. Wen Ho Lee's case is really extraordinary, and I'm reluctant to summarize it now, although I read a lot about it, and I read his memoir of sort of what he endured as he was being investigated. And, you know, ultimately, he was never proven guilty of any of the things of which he was charged, and he was the recipient of this sort of extraordinary apology from the bench on the part of a federal judge who said to him, you know, Mr. Lee, the government has not, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially said the government has not been fair to you. And well, I followed that case really closely, and that case and my thoughts about that case did definitely, you know, seep their ways into this book.
Well, he got an apology from the courts, but what about the community? Did the community ever receive him with open arms again? What happens to a life once it's been...
Once it's been sort of hung out to dry, in the public eye?
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly the question that I found so compelling when I was writing this book, because I follow all these cases in the news, as we all do, but then I think, what's happened to this person's life? My God, you know, what is this person feeling when he or she is lying in bed at night trying to get some sleep? You know, like, does this person even have the stomach to eat breakfast in the morning? I mean, what does it feel like when they open up the garage door and have to back their car out into the driveway and there's maybe the news media sitting at the end of their driveway or their neighbors? You know, I find that so compelling, these sort of hidden in plain sight, the more intimate devastation of what happens to these lives.
I can imagine the stress took years off of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Eileen, Lee's first wife. Why couldn't they make it?
Wow, that marriage was so troubled from the very beginning. Lee meets Eileen, the only woman he ever loves, and he loves her deeply, and much of this book goes back to his life as a young man. We find out that Lee at 65 harbors a lifetime of regrets, and the book starts to delve into the past and into these regrets that that are just sort of eating away at him. Eileen was the wife of his only friend in graduate school, the only person who sort of reached out across the abyss and kind of tried to connect with him. And the friendship lasted a short time until Lee met his friend's young wife and fell sort of devastatingly in love with her. They begin an extramarital affair, Lee and Eileen. And you know, you could argue that a marriage founded on those circumstances maybe was never going to work out very well. But they're also sort of passionately, they're impassioned people, and their passions run very high in both directions.
Actually, it's almost as if Lee never really divorces Eileen in his mind, even though they're divorced, you know, legally, because he keeps going back to her in his mind for support, I guess.
That's well, right. Not only after their divorce, but after her death. He never really stops being married to her in his heart.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And his utterly unresolved emotions about Eileen are really central to sort of what he goes through in this book, because, you know, in a way that's complicated and I think very exciting, and I don't want to reveal because I want people to buy the book.
Right,
but
right.
This bombing that Lee becomes sort of swept up in actually does unearth also all of these moments and pains from his past, including his marriage to Eileen, and he's sort of forced to come to terms with his marriage to Eileen and the fact that he's never really let go of it, despite the fact that by the time the book begins, she's been dead for almost 10 years.
And is that what impacted his second marriage, as to why that didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, the way he thinks of his second marriage is almost, you know, he thinks of it almost as a period of delusion. It wasn't him.
What do you mean by that? I mean...
Well, again, when the book opens, you know, the second marriage is also over. He had tried, it went very, very poorly. And the difference between it and the first marriage to Eileen is that the first marriage to Eileen, as you say, is still sort of psychically very central to Lee. He's still very deeply involved with her, even though she's gone. The second marriage, it was a terrible experience, a terrible divorce, but he's kind of closed the door on it. Mm-hmm. That Eileen, he cannot close the door on.
What's the good in the book in terms of what we can pull from it that would be uplifting?
You know, in the end, Lee is really healed, I think. And the irony of this explosion, this literal explosion that sort of turns his life upside down, is that it unearths all of these unresolved issues from his past that, because they're unearthed and kind of thrown in his face, he does have to resolve them. And there's one particular relationship that is utterly unresolved, and because of his notoriety, this person with whom Lee has never been able to resolve his relationship, this person comes back to him and he's given a second chance, and he succeeds. Mm-hmm. The second time around he succeeds, and he does come out of the book redeemed, I think.
So redemption is always possible. I wonder if he didn't, maybe part of Lee's problem was that he didn't really understand, or you tell me, was it because he didn't understand the nuances of the American culture? Although, was he an immigrant, or was Lee?
He is an immigrant. Mm-hmm. He is an immigrant, but I don't think it's, I didn't ever think of Lee as being someone who didn't understand American culture. He is to me an almost quintessential American. Just because he happens to be foreign born doesn't mean he's not
right.
American to his core, you know. But he finds it very, very difficult to be a hypocrite. He's very true to himself,
right.
And you know, when people are true to themselves, and when that self is difficult or remote or you know, tied up in its own private knots, so that it doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. say the friendly word to the neighbor when picking up the newspaper in the morning. I mean, you know, I think that he's just very much his own person, which is one of the reasons that I loved him as a character. But it's one of the reasons that he finds himself, you know, going against the grain of, I think, a society that wants everyone to keep up appearances and put on a smile.
Mm-hmm. And be in lockstep, right. We didn't talk about his friend, is it Fasano? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right.
Yeah, Fasano.
Yeah, tell us about him a bit first.
Yeah, Lee has this one friend, and it's explained in the book that the fact that he and this one friend have been out of touch for virtually a decade and a half is only evidence of how alike they are. This was a fellow professor of his who, when he went to teach at a different university, he and Lee completely lost touch because neither of them is good at doing those, you know, socially acceptable things like, you know, the phone calls and the letters, or I guess these days the emails. But when Lee gets into trouble, Fasano is there for him. He gets in touch right away, and he's the one person who is really kindred spirit to Lee. Also, you know, a solitary man, also, you know, veteran of divorce, grown children that he's not getting along with very well. But he understands Lee, and he and Lee share a very unforced friendship that really almost saves Lee's life, that he has this one friend who mm-hmm. believes in him.
You know, Lee goes from being basically invisible to being a notorious person of interest. At times, he even seemed to doubt his own innocence, although he knew he didn't do it, but maybe it was just that his self-esteem was so destroyed. But how did he lift himself back up after being down so far in terms of his own self-esteem?
Well, I mean, it's true that sometimes it's hard for him to believe in his own innocence because he has this very physical reaction of guilt and fear when he's put under scrutiny, which I think we all have in a way. I mean, you know, when I get pulled over by the cops for speeding, I panic right away. I feel like maybe I've robbed a bank too. You know, I know I haven't, but I think that we all sort of have that panicked reaction. And so, in Lee's case, it's not really low self-esteem so much as sort of this the mutability of guilt. You know, he harbors a lot of guilt in his heart toward the people he loved, but. You know, when other things of which he might be guilty are presented to him, you know, he has that emotion of guilt in reaction, if that makes sense.
He also feels very guilty about his relationship with his daughter. Why has that been so difficult?
Yeah, I mean, his relationship with his daughter has been handicapped from the start. You know, his marriage with Eileen, as we've discussed, was very tempestuous. By the time his daughter was even a very small girl, that marriage was under severe strain. And then Eileen dies quite young when Lee's daughter is just an adolescent, at the worst possible time, really. So, you know, for a father and daughter, they've had a very, very rocky road, even if Lee had been a sort of an easy person to get along with. And Esther, in many ways, his daughter, is, you know, she's her father's daughter. She's not the easiest person in the world either. So by the time of the book's beginning, they've sort of just put each other at a distance. Mm-hmm. But this is something that Lee suffers terrible grief over, and this is also something that by the end of the book is repaired.
You're right. He actually has to take almost like a full inventory of his past and his decisions in the past and the impact that they've made on the future. This is a very interesting book, A Person of Interest. It really does get into the kind of underground, almost paranoid subtext of our country. Thank you very much, Susan, for being with us today. Susan Choi's book is A Person of Interest.
Thank you.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go Between the Lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Murray. Production assistant, Soo Young Jung. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.